Georgia's DBHDD is warning all Georgians that half of all opioid deaths happen at home, when people take an Oxy or a Perc with a glass of alcohol for stress or to sleep. Learn more about protecting families from opioid overdoses at opioidresponse.info.
Thank you all for joining us for another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut, and as always, I'm very happy to have you with us for our show today. You know, there are so many different directions we could go in today. So much political news is kind of popping all over the place. But I realize that the best way to organize today's show is to do it around the fact that two of our panelists today are both sitting in their cars in a parking lot of a gun shop in Smyrna, waiting for a major announcement from Governor Brian Kemp. So I can't think of a better way to start today than to talk about the fact that Governor Kemp is essentially going to, in a short while, announce that he will support legislation for what is known kind of loosely as constitutional carry, but we'll talk about what that means to Governor Kemp with all of the members of our panel. But as to those two who are in their cars waiting for the announcement, one is our regular Wednesday AJC partner, Greg Bluestein. You know him as one of the top political reporters in the Southeast. And Greg, thank you for being with us. Greg, we should point out to our listeners that although we normally don't talk about it, you've done this show numerous times from the scene, from your car at the scene of political events you're either about to walk into or have just finished.
Yeah, unfortunately, the campaigns don't cater to us. They don't necessarily work around our schedules all the time. So we're often on the road. And you know, you've seen the inside of my beautiful Honda Accord many times. And here I am again.
Emma Hurt, Axios Atlanta, is also sitting in her car at the parking lot waiting for the Kemp event. How are you doing, Emma?
Doing great. Bill, it's a beautiful day here in Smyrna. And I would just say, Greg, I mean, they did set it to start at 10:15. So they did, you know, they gave us like
better
a
9:45.
All right. We're also joined today by GPB public policy reporter Riley Bunch. Riley, how have you been?
Doing great. It's, you know, kind of a crazy time right now. We're talking about Georgia politics heating up, but there's a couple of anniversaries I know we're going to talk about today. But it's just crazy to think January 6th happened yesterday or a year ago tomorrow, you know, things like that. So
absolutely,
it's a weird time.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will talk about that a bit, as well as the anniversary today, 1 year since John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock were elected in their runoffs to the U.S. Senate, tipping the balance of the Senate to the Democratic Party. And we'll talk about that in a little while. But before we do, we should also introduce the managing editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Leroy Chapman, who is back with us. How you doing, Leroy?
I am fantastic, Bill. Thanks for having me, and it's a great time to be in journalism.
Boy, we will all second that statement, I think. All right, Greg, so let's talk about this Kemp news conference this morning. What exactly is he preparing to announce?
Yeah, you mentioned it, they call it constitutional carry, although that is a very broad definition. But essentially, he wants to back a plan that would allow Georgians to carry concealed weapons without a state permit. It would vastly expand where Georgians can carry their concealed weapons, and it would be probably the biggest expansion of gun rights since at least 2014, when then Governor Nathan Deal signed what critics called the Guns Everywhere Bill that allowed more people to carry weapons into places like churches and restaurants and schools and government buildings.
We've taken a look at a draft of what Kemp's remarks are likely to be, Emma Hurt. And among other things, he is set to say, building a safer, stronger Georgia starts with hardworking Georgians having the ability to protect themselves and their families in the face of rising violent crime across the country. Law-abiding citizens should have their constitutional rights protected. And clearly, Emma, there is a political side to this announcement today.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there is. Governor Kemp has a very strong primary challenge now, but it's important to note that, you know, he has always talked about gun rights said it was a priority last year, tried to pass an expansion of gun rights, and that stalled in the legislature. That would have, I believe, required Georgia to recognize other states' concealed weapons permits. But, you know, things are different this year. Partially things are different because Speaker Ralston has indicated that he's open to something like constitutional carry. And last year he was behind the stall of HB 218, Kemp's attempt last year. So politics is always changing the way that these things may go down.
Leroy, this is clearly one of those hot button issues that will find a divided voting public taking different positions on this.
Absolutely. So this is, again, the fruit of a primary that is already heated, that will be smoldering pretty soon and will be sort of unlike any we've perhaps seen in modern Georgia political history. So being able to outflank your opponent with something like this, which is speaking not to all of Georgia, this speaks to primary voters. And so that's what that is. And I think the second part of this, too, is, you know, this is the governor. He's proposing something that would change, you know, how the process by which someone can carry a concealed weapon. And I'd love to hear from him the number of times or the scenarios by which Georgians who are eligible to have a concealed carry are denied, because many of the reasons why some are denied are very good reasons. And therefore, as a newspaper, we'll be looking at, you know, the practical application of what this might mean.
Riley?
You know, I don't think it's surprising to see Kemp bring this specific issue up. It was something he talked about in his campaign in 2018, but it didn't make a priority, you know, during his State of the State addresses, during pushing other legislative reforms in the legislature. But it is something that, you know, there is a strong likelihood of passing in the Republican-held legislature. We know there was, as Emma mentioned, that gun reciprocity law that was stalled last year by the speaker, and that had a large part to do with the horrific spa shootings that we saw. But this also brings up an issue that we're going to see in the legislative session this year, which is, are we going to see these hot button issues over some more common sense reforms that we want to be pushing? You know, how much of these social issues are going to drive the conversation? And it's going to be a lot.
Greg, let's point out where you are exactly. The event is scheduled to take place at a gun store which bills itself as the world's largest gun store, right?
Yeah, this is called Adventure Outdoors. We're in a giant Smyrna parking lot where, yes, it's a huge gun range. And it's also the home of many Republican rallies over the years, including a runoff rally last year that featured Travis Tritt, the country music singer, right here in this very same parking lot I'm at right now. And it always, you know, brings back, just to kind of highlight what folks have been saying earlier, Kemp endorsed this idea in 2018. This was something that became a Republican litmus test in that 2018 campaign for governor, but also at the same time, never really put his political, never made this a political priority for him until now. And his endorsement, this is one of his first legislative agenda items, the main legislative items that he's actually voiced support for. We don't know much of his legislative agenda yet, and we're only less than a week before the legislative session, but we do know that he's putting his political capital behind this. So that says something about this election season.
Emma?
And I just think it's interesting because as we think about, you know, 2018 to now, we would have assumed a year ago that Kemp would be most focused on beating Stacey Abrams and that we wouldn't see, you know, the vestige of the Jake ads with, you know, Governor Kemp in a pickup truck holding a gun and pointing a gun at this guy trying to date his daughter. But here we are, and things have changed. I think the Kemp team would bristle at that, saying, obviously, as we've said, Kemp has always been pro gun rights, but his priorities have had to change with this political reality.
So I want to talk about this just a little bit more. First of all, Riley, Speaker Ralston has indicated that he very well might support legislation around, again, this vague issue of constitutional carry. So we suspect that the tracks may already be greased for this measure to get to move forward pretty, if not quickly, certainly without too much protest from certainly other Republican leaders. But how are Democrats going to address this? It's interesting. Let me add this. I'm fascinated by the fact that Marty Kemp, the governor's wife, is part of this news conference today because they're making it clear that women have a vested interest, a stake, it seems to me, in having the ability to carry a weapon. They don't want this to become a gender issue where, you know, gun carrying is a masculine sort of thing.
Well, I think that, you know, that's including the entire Republican Party, even women in this issue, works to the GOP's advantage, right? But as I mentioned before, this is going to be one of those issues that comes up during the legislative session that Democrats are going to use in their advantage too, right? Look, the GOP wants to push all these loosening of gun laws, right? You know, on top of all the election change that happened last year, it just sets the stage for such a tumultuous session ahead of the primary, ahead of the next election season. And also, you know, we have to remember so many of the lawmakers are running for higher office, right? And Democrats included. So if they don't stand up against these more social issue pieces of legislation in a strong way, it hurts Democrats as much as Republicans not bringing this kind of legislation.
Leroy, one last point about this before we move on. And I've noticed this in a number of Kemp's statements recently. He has once again, and he's been using it throughout his tenure as governor, but it was certainly a hallmark of his campaign as well, the phrase hardworking Georgians. In this case, it's building a safer, stronger Georgia starts with hardworking Georgians having the ability to protect themselves and their families. There are many people who think that phrase is a pointed reference that distinguishes the people who he feels are different than those who take advantage of the social safety network. I'm not quite sure what to make of that.
Long before Kemp ran for governor for a while now, and you can go back to even Mitt Romney and talking about the 47%, there's been this whole makers and takers mentality among some Republicans who say that, our core voters are the folks who make America work and everyone else are the people who benefit from us. So that phrasing is intentional. And in a primary, it's intended to say, I'm speaking to you, to these people. And there is an undercurrent to it. So, yes. And just to amplify something that that Riley said too about the implication of women being involved in this and this being sort of cast as something that is not gender specific, that he has to do that because everything that both he and Perdue do to outflank each other to the right, they're going to have to answer to that in short order when we get to a general election, and so that's. It's shrewd, it's necessary, and we'll see more of that sort of programming where on the one hand, he's trying to outflank, they will try to outflank each other, but on the other hand, too, they'll have an eye toward a general election where they're going to have to walk away from some of this stuff, too, in order to win a closely contested Georgia. And so that's going to happen, too.
Greg, let me give you a chance to wrap this up for us before we move on.
Yeah, at the same time that Republicans are moving to the right on guns, Democrats are moving towards the left. And that might make sense now. That might seem like it's normal. But not so long ago, Georgia Democrats were running as NRA Democrats. Jason Carter in the 2014 campaign for governor even voted for that giant gun rights expansion that I just mentioned earlier. So Democrats have now uniformly opposed these expansions in a way that they weren't not so long ago because polls are indicating not just left-leaning voters, but more centrist voters as well are firmly opposed to these sort of legislation. So this is clearly an effort from Kemp to energize conservative voters that he might not have had to do had David Perdue not been in this contest.
Okay, Greg, but one thing about the Jason Carter endorsement of a gun bill, he got a lot of criticism from Democrats for doing that. And there are many people who felt that worked against him as he tried to get Democratic votes, right?
He did. He said he wanted to take guns off the table. He didn't want to become a wedge issue. He voted for it to keep the focus on expanding Medicaid and other priorities of his at the time. But he was not alone. You know, there were a lot of Democrats who opposed it, but there's a decent number of Democrats who also supported expanding gun rights at the time, echoing, you know, what Governor Roy Barnes, you know, who, he ran as an NRA Democrat. He had the NRA's endorsement. And so it wasn't too long ago that Democrats had a very different stance on guns.
Okay, let's move on. Riley, yesterday on the show, I gave out figures about the number of new COVID cases that I thought had been reported as of Monday. It turned out that it was only late yesterday or in the middle of the day yesterday that the Georgia DPH was finally able to give us data on how many new cases, how many new hospitalizations had taken place over the long four-day New Year's weekend. And it turns out that the number is pretty staggering. Some 60,000 new COVID-19 cases in the state of Georgia just over that four-day period. And I mention it now because at the same time that we get those numbers, we're seeing Republicans in the state rejoicing over the fact that the Attorney General, Chris Carr, and Governor Kemp have won another battle to stop a federal mandate, which would have required mask wearing in Head Start programs. And I find the juxtapositioning of those two things kind of interesting right now, Riley.
Well, I think it's also really good context to include that the DPH kind of crash and this struggle to report data is so reminiscent of the early days of the pandemic when we were seeing these huge spikes. And I think it's important to mention when we talk about the severity of the Omicron variant. But pivoting to that lawsuit, you know, this a judge blocked part of Biden's vaccine mandate that would, like you said, require Head Start students across the country. This is a federal funded program for early learning for students. I think it has some 380, I think the AJC reported, locations across Georgia, but it blocked a mask mandate for those students is about 2 years old and up. And this is another win in the federal court system for Republicans that are spending a lot of time and money to push back against Biden's federal vaccine mandate. And I think it's really interesting to see when you compare it to the election lawsuits that we see Republicans push in federal courts that are not winning. You know, they are not being successful, but you're seeing Republicans win on this kind of COVID public policy front, which is really interesting. And I wonder if there will be a case where they don't win one of these. But right now, Republicans are seeing huge wins in courts with this.
Emma?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but it just having Biden in the White House gives Georgia Republicans who don't agree on a lot of things right now something to agree on and something to unite behind. And it's almost a political gift in some way for there to be a very clear opponent. And Kemp and Carr have been using their offices and platforms to take that to the next level. And as Riley said, it's been working.
Leroy, as this Omicron variant spirals out of control, and let me be cautious here, Georgia DPH has not told us whether this big spike over the 4 days is necessarily propelled by Omicron as opposed to Delta. But as Omicron does spread so rapidly, it's interesting to watch how not just Governor Kemp, but Republican governors and leaders in other states right now in an election year, a little cautious about how far they want to go in mitigation efforts because their base is so against things like mask mandates. Remote working is always an issue for some of them. Anything that smacks of a government effort to impose its will on the people.
So, you know, we've during the pandemic, What's been pretty clear is that there's been a big impact with misinformation. And also the politicalization of this has meant that being able to cherry pick some facts to create a narrative has been has served some advantage throughout this. And one thing about Omicron is that if because it so far it's less deadly. Folks who get it, the symptoms are more like the common cold. And if you're a Republican who has chosen to downplay the severity of this in order to be able to support or to say that these mandates are onerous, there's a little bit of data there to support the threat, so to speak. And so it's all about the conversation and the context. So that's really kind of an explanation as to why on this particular moment where we've seen an escalation, but some of the worst of what we've not seen that we've seen before, which are hospitalizations, deaths. Hospitalizations are going up, but deaths aren't. You can cherry pick your facts, and you can basically make a case that mandates are onerous, that people should be able to take care of themselves. So that's kind of the moment we're in. But the thing about that, of course, is that we don't know what the next moment's going to be. So to have the public on that type of footing where they believe that this is not a threat, but we don't know how severe the next mutation is going to be. So from a standpoint of leadership, there's some obvious danger there.
Greg?
It seems like if it can be a political issue in Georgia in 2022, it will be a political issue in Georgia in 2022. And every decision Kemp makes might not be completely influenced by the epic squeezes in between David Perdue on the right and Stacey Abrams on the left, but many of them will be. And you're already seeing this, not just with these legal battles over masks and vaccine mandates, but even the decision by local school districts to close their doors and offer only online virtual learning this week, including my kids' school district in DeKalb County. David Perdue immediately attacked Governor Kemp over that, saying that he caved to liberals, even though a reminder that he has no power over what local school districts do when it comes to closing doors for virtual learning. That the state doesn't have that power to block schools unless they take certain executive actions to do so. So it's just everything is going to be politicized, and this mask mandate business with the rise of variants beyond Omicron will continue to play into the election campaign season.
Riley, we know that this is a winning proposition, or we imagine it is, for many in the Republican base. And we also don't know where COVID is going to stand once we move toward a general election campaign down the road. But I find it interesting that while President Biden, one of the reasons we know his approval numbers have dropped so dramatically is because a great percentage of the country doesn't think he's somehow done the right thing in mitigating the virus. The question is, if this is an ongoing problem well into 2022, if he wins his primary battle, whether this is an issue that will cause Brian Kemp some difficulties in his reelection campaign and a campaign against Stacey Abrams.
I think Brian Kemp has done a fair job throughout the pandemic of keeping that in the back of his mind, though. We've seen him stay on message about a lot of the things that he will absolutely not do, right? Absolutely no mask mandates, absolutely no vaccine requirements. We had restrictions. Georgia, quote, never shut down for business, right? I think Kemp has done a good job of kind of sticking with that, but it's definitely going to be an issue that comes up in 2022, especially when we don't know, like you said, Bill, where the virus is going to be. It could be much worse then. And Democrats as well can use this as such a standing for their Medicaid and Medicare arguments, right? Think of the impact of that during the pandemic. And it's definitely something that we are going to see Stacey Abrams, use in her campaign in a more policy-driven way, I think. But Kemp has really, truly stayed on his same course throughout the entire pandemic, I would think.
Okay, let's do this. Let's get to our first break of Political Rewind for today. I'm looking at the list of topics that we have available to discuss, and there's just so many of them. We'll get to a few of them after these messages. AJC Managing Editor Leroy Chapman, Axios Atlanta's Emma Hurt, GPB's Riley Bunch, and the AJC's Greg Bluestein join me for today's show. A quick program note before we return to our conversation. Tomorrow morning, NPR is going to broadcast a special looking back on the one-year anniversary of the insurrection at the United States Capitol, one of the darkest days in American history, really. And so we're going to move aside on the 9 o'clock political rewind to give room for that NPR programming. But we will be doing a live 2 o'clock show tomorrow afternoon. So we hope you can join us for that. Among other things, we'll be talking about Johnny Isaacson, whose funeral service is tomorrow, and we'll duck into that service and listen a little to what people are saying about the late Senator Johnny Isaacson. So just for tomorrow, we're going to give way to NPR at 9 o'clock. Okay, let's get back to the conversation. Greg, we already said two big anniversaries. One, the insurrection tomorrow, 1 year since that took place. But today's a really important day. This is the day that Georgia voters went to the polls in the U.S. Senate runoff elections and elected John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, gave control of the United States Senate to Democrats. And after Georgia went for Joe Biden in November, it began this sense that Georgia is now more in play than it's ever been in decades and decades, and becomes one of the most important states in the country in 2022.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you talk about impact in Georgia, of course, giving Democrats hope for actually winning a statewide contest in 2022, but also the national impact. I mean, the effect this had on Joe Biden's administration, the cabinet members that sailed through Senate approval that would not have gotten that such easy passage. The $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package that would have been probably significantly smaller if Republicans controlled the U.S. Senate, because there was already a lot of pushback on previous efforts. The infrastructure package, the fact that there is even debate about voting rights legislation and the Build Back Better plan. I mean, none of this would have been possible if Democrats hadn't swept those contests and flipped control of the chamber. And also, of course, on the Republican side, the fact that Republicans are still as focused as ever on the 2020 election fraud lies plays into that, because they don't have control of the U.S. Senate. They can't. They don't have any avenue to push forward their own agenda on Capitol Hill. Probably helps reframe that conversation even more to focus on 2020 than 2022.
Yeah, you know, Riley, that strikes me as everything Greg said is absolutely correct. But that final point he made, it in many ways is the reason the big lie perseveres to this day and continues to drive so much of the agenda, both in Washington, but here in Georgia particularly. We know, for example, Riley, that there are going to be pieces of legislation introduced in this upcoming session to further restrict voting in the state. Not only are we going to see a bill from Burt Jones running for lieutenant governor, supported by former President Trump, to eliminate drop boxes, but now there's going to be a bill calling for the elimination of most of the electronic voting machines in the state, which the state just spent, $138 million to put in place, and a return to hand balloting. All of this driven by the false claims of Donald Trump and his allies.
And I think it's a really interesting thing to talk about when we talk about how much control the Democrats have at a federal level, right? Because even though we see this unified control and we have this voting power in the Senate now, where you can override your Republican colleagues, you know, there was such a mirror held up to the country of how much power Republicans held legislatures truly have. And I think that this was yesterday. There was actually a press conference in Congress with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Warnock was among the lawmakers there who basically came out and said, you know what, we're going to use our tie-breaking power a little bit more strongly to get federal voting rights reform passed this month because we're seeing this kind of change in the Republican-held legislatures. Warnock mentioned that proposal to eliminate ballot drop boxes. So I think we may see, you know, Democrats at the federal level act a little bit more aggressively on this voting rights issue because it was so proven that Republican-held legislatures have so much power.
Leroy?
Yeah, so what we're talking about here, again, is Georgia being having an outsized influence now on a couple of national debates, and voting is probably top of the list, right? So, and if you look at where we've come from just a little more than a year ago, and I have to give Greg and David Wickard and Mark Nisi a shout out for the package that they did, which is on AJC.com right now. What we're talking about really is our voting system is fragile. Our voting system not only needs laws that are constitutional, but people who are willing to put their own interests aside in order to give the American people, Georgians, a voting system that works for them, and that we've got laws that benefit everyone, that the playing field is equal, and that no matter the result, we all stand by them. So for generations, I think we've all lived with the idea that that was something that would always happen in America until now. So I say all that just to say that on the federal level, Democrats are energized because what they see is a continuation of laws that are being proposed that are about election advantage, not necessarily about improving the system and making it more fair and accessible for everyone, but is meant to take advantage of political strategy, and that's going to continue.
Emma, jump in.
Yeah, thinking about 1 year after the runoffs and now that Senator Warnock is in office, you know, having voting rights as a national issue, he has this really rare gravitas to bring to the issue as the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, which Martin Luther King Jr. and his father were both pastors of as well. And it, you know, we've seen this get tied up. We saw Senator Schumer set Martin Luther King Day as a deadline to try to get this through. We saw Martin Luther King III threaten to encourage people to withhold celebrations of MLK Day unless federal voting legislation is passed. And having Warnock in the Senate makes a big difference when they're talking about it. You saw him speaking with Senator Schumer yesterday, and it's just another example and perhaps the most relevant example right now to the fact that Senators Ossoff and Warnock are wielding more power than the average freshman senators would. I mean, within a month, when the American Rescue Plan was passed, they had a private press conference with Leader Schumer, which would be kind of unheard of for freshman senators, but it speaks to the remarkable way they were elected a year ago.
Riley, Sam Burmistaz just pointed out to me that we just posted a story on the GPB News website that you published, that you wrote on Warnock's push for voting rights, especially in response to the latest news about the Omicron variant, which doesn't seem to be creating too many problems. He believes for Republicans being concerned about it, they're more concerned about, he says, suppressing the vote. Here's the quote you have from him. Think about that. In the middle of a pandemic with the Omicron variant, we don't know what the days ahead will bring. Some think that their duty is to get rid of drop boxes. It is very clear what the Republican Party is up to. They're trying to make it harder for some people to vote. He also said in his news conference that there are going to be Republicans who are going to be going to the King celebration at Ebenezer Baptist Church, and he finds that there's a certain hypocrisy in their efforts to pass new voting laws and honoring Dr. King.
Yeah, and I think these were kind of stinging words from Warnock yesterday that we don't always hear from him. You know, he's not always bringing up his service at the pulpit. Like he was very, very passionate about that yesterday in a way that we don't see in a while, we haven't seen in a while, I would say. And I think it really truly is because it's a frustration level, right? They have all this power at the federal level, but they're continuing to see this push by Republican legislatures across the country where they're being successful. And I would also argue, you know, a lot of these things that we're seeing filed in the legislature are by lawmakers who are seeking higher office, right? This whole concern about campaign stunts kind of dominating the legislature this year. But I also think that Warnock, he is up for re-election, right? This is his main issue. If he does not go full force on this, you know, what is he going to go full force on? So it was pretty stinging words from him yesterday.
All right. Thank you for all of that. Greg, I'd like to turn to the other anniversary, which, of course, is one that people are going to be spending a lot of time talking about. They have been already this week and certainly will be tomorrow. It was 1 year ago today that the Trump-supporting insurrectionists stormed the United States Capitol, a horrific event. We were on the air live as that unfolded because we were doing a live show at 2 o'clock that day. And like most Americans, I certainly am not going to forget what I saw, even while we were on the air watching the show move forward. Greg, your thoughts about tomorrow?
Yeah, I woke up January 6th thinking the big story would be the formal calls of the runoffs, right? We were planning a big, giant front page package. And then it turned out that the biggest election we've had in Georgia in modern history ended up going below the fold because of the January 6th insurrection. And I'll never forget kind of being groggy watching the live feeds of this all happening and listening to your show. And it took a while for the magnitude of this to hit me. And it probably took until going to the state capitol where Governor Kemp had called hastily called a press conference where he said that we will remain secure and that we will that Georgia National Guardsmen will be protecting the capitol because he didn't want the state capitol turned into an armed camp, for it to strike home to me about how just what a threat this was to American democracy and how important it is for us in the media and our listeners to remember what happened and to not let people try to whitewash and lionize these insurrectionists as some kind of heroes for storming the Capitol and trying to block the peaceful transition of power in a democracy. Because that's exactly what's happening now. There's several events tomorrow that plan to call these folks patriots when of course they're not. And they're being charged in a court of law and we'll see how that turns out. But either way, we saw with our very own eyes what this violent mob tried to do on January 6th.
And Bill, you know, you brought up the taping of that show. I was actually on that show that day, and I will never forget that. It was me, Tamar Holloman at the AJC, and Fred Smith. And we were on the show to talk about the significance of Warnock being elected as the first Black U.S. senator from Georgia. And our conversation had to pivot, and your producers so skillfully were breaking news to us on air. And I will never, ever forget that moment for as long as I live. And, you know, thinking now, a year later, it is going to be so important about how we talk about that event. Like Greg brought up, how the media remembers that event. It's so important. And I think this first year anniversary will be mark how we talk about it going forward in terms of how politicians react to it, how local parties, GOP parties react to it, right? This year anniversary is so important. And it gave me chills when you mentioned that show because it was so it was so shocking. It was so shocking. And I don't think a lot of people could have even fathomed that would have happened.
Leroy, as Greg Bluestein already pointed out, the AJC had to move into action very, very quickly to respond to that story and get a paper out, get web stories out as quickly as possible, and then a paper for the next day.
We did. And the one thing that I will never forget is desperately texting Tia Mitchell, who is our Washington, D.C. correspondent, who was inside the Capitol when it was happening, who was moved by Capitol Police, Secret Service, and everyone who had to respond once there was a breach. and to not hear from her for a long time, and to have to rely on other sources as you can get them, just to make sure that someone you're responsible for is safe. And then to hear after, as she talked about what she heard, but also what she could see on some of the feeds that she was able to get. So imagine being in the building and then being able to see what was happening on the exterior and then what happened after the breach. So just harrowing moments. And so it was something that I did not expect, and I don't think any of us did. The peaceful transfer of power for us, again, is something that in our lifetimes is something that we've always expected. But we did raise the question about this with this particular president, and our worst fears became a reality. And so on that day, if you're in the media, like Greg said, I mean, we were at the governor's office. It's not only what's happening in D.C., but what could happen in Georgia. And we were scrambling reporters out to the Georgia State House to see what would happen. We have a reporter who is very good at tracking extremism, and we were looking at what some of that messaging might mean. And it was a harrowing time, and one that this nation should never forget.
Emma, I assume you were still reporting at WABE at that point.
I was, and you know, I got bumped off of the NPR rundown to talk about Warnock and Ossoff because of this. Which was kind of incredible to think about if you had known the results. And yeah, I think I kind of remember Riley and Greg, I guess you were there too at the press conference at the Capitol, or maybe Riley, you were on air, I don't know. But it was such a dazed moment where we're all just sort of standing there listening to Ralston and Lieutenant Governor Duncan and Governor Kemp, you know, condemn that as it was happening. It was another example of, you know, there was just such a different tone coming from them than from President Trump at that time and from some other Georgia politicians who were sort of speaking to the rioters in a more respectful way or even inciting them. Yeah, I remember Governor Kemp calling it un-American and a disgrace. And it was like one of the few press conferences where we didn't have very many questions. It was just we were all kind of in shock and didn't know what to say.
Yeah. Okay. There'll be a lot of reporting tomorrow on this anniversary. And again, we will do a live 2 o'clock show in which we'll certainly talk more about the insurrection and how it has been interpreted in the year since by partisans on both sides. Let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way and come back with more on today's Political Rewind. Greg Lucian, we already talked earlier in the show a little bit about David Perdue and Brian Kemp and their campaign against one another, their fight for the Republican nomination for governor. But let's go back to it because you reported that, and I'll read the lead, former U.S. Senator David Perdue has loaded his campaign for governor with experienced operatives, including several strategists who were once allied with Brian Kemp. It's an indication the former senator's bid to unseat Kemp will be a professional operation not to be taken lightly. And, Greg, that's the first thing I thought about when I read this. Anybody who thinks somehow that David Perdue isn't deadly serious about taking the governor's seat away from Brian Kemp will understand from this article this is the real deal.
Yeah, and the veteran politicos, after that jolt item came out, I got a lot of texts from people saying, holy cow, this is, you know, I don't think a lot of folks realized, even in the political world, the team that David Perdue has assembled. Taylor Brown, David Perdue's campaign manager, was Kelly Loeffler's campaign manager the last cycle, very well-respected strategist. He has Kemp's former TV consultant on board. He's got many veterans of Glenn Youngkin's campaign as field operatives stationed around the state. And he's got experienced pollsters and media consultants and all sorts of, and a political director, just up and down, and they're still hiring. You know, Governor Kemp has a lot of experienced hands as well. And many people from his official office have already moved over to the campaign, including Cody Hall, his chief spokesman. But there's going to be kind of an arms race right now for talented staffers and you know, who aren't going over to the Senate contests in Georgia because there's already a beefed up Herschel Walker campaign on too.
I can hear the cars of Republican strategists driving in from other states to come get jobs in Georgia.
We're watching at the parking lot right now, Emma.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's move on to another subject very briefly. Riley, I know you covered Andre Dickens' inaugural swearing in as the new mayor of the city of Atlantic. Just give us, what do you think were the, what are the highlights? What did he say yesterday that struck you as important?
You know, Atlanta has this is their 61st mayor, finally. And I think this was kind of a long-awaited moment for a lot of people. And the inauguration ceremony was at Bobby Dodd Stadium, Georgia Tech, Dickens' alma mater. And I thought it was, you know, it was nice to hear a little bit about his past. So he talked about being an usher in the stadium when he was in college and, you know, fed that into a quote of he's ushering in this new day for Atlanta. But it was this very, the speech ringing with optimism, right? And I think that's the tone that he needed right now in such a time of uncertainty for Atlanta. We're seeing this rise in violent crime, as we are seeing in other places too. But, you know, there's such a focus on it here and the Buckhead secession movement, and his speech needed to have that optimism, I think. But it also had a lengthy list of action items that he pledged he was going to do. 250 police officers hired in the first year, you know, 20,000 affordable housing units in 8 years. So he was clear to outline a lot of his plans, and it'll be interesting to see if he's able to hold up to them.
Emma, we should point out that Doug Shipman was sworn in as president of city council yesterday. And while we're used to kind of a battle between city council presidents and mayors, it is fascinating that Shipman and Dickens have a pretty long history and have worked together on a number of projects. And Shipman has actually said, I sort of see myself as a chairman of the board. I got to fight for the transparency, but I've also got to do what I can to support the CEO, Mayor Dickens.
Yeah, it is interesting. And maybe that's what happens when you, I mean, Shipman is an outsider to city government. So his, you know, relationships are different than past city council presidents we've had. And also, you know, Dickens has said that he is, he draws circles, not lines, you know, he's about working with other people. So we'll see how that lasts, though, I will say, you know, tensions may arise, as they often do. But for now, yeah, it looks different.
Andre, another thing that struck me was that Shirley Franklin is the tie that binds between these two. I mean, Andre Dickens and Shirley Franklin have had a long, very close partnership. She's known him since he was a teenage friend of her late son's. And Shipman was hired away from his consulting work by Shirley Franklin to be the first CEO of the Center for Civil and Human, I mean, the Center for Civil and Human Rights. So Shirley Franklin reestablishes a certain kind of gravitas that is she hasn't really been able to have in the last couple of administrations.
Well, I'll say this. I think that former Mayor Franklin, who obviously endorsed Andre very early, has shown that the city probably needed someone who was going to be what Andre brings, and part of it was new politics that certainly has a lot of credibility with old Atlanta, and that's kind of the way he built himself. And I will say this finally, that the mayor's number one priority has to be Buckhead, because if Buckhead is lost, then the rest of his term is really going to be defined by the aftermath of Buckhead. And so I know he has a long list, but that list probably really is one issue.
Greg, very quickly, Dickens did make Buckhead a big part of his speech yesterday.
Yeah, and I was there on the frigid Georgia Tech football grounds. It wasn't just Andre Dickens who talked about it, but pretty much every speaker highlighted unity, highlighted the need for Atlanta to be preserved as one city. And if there's one argument that Andre Dickens will make to state lawmakers, it's going to be give me time. He wants time to be able to enact that plan, to hire more police officers, get more security cameras up, and have a more robust law enforcement presence.
All right, Greg Bluestein gets the last word on today's show. Thank you, Greg, for being here. You as well, Emma Hurt, Riley Bunch, Leroy Chapman. Thanks for a terrific conversation. Before we leave, I have one quick personal note. Yesterday, Illinois Congressman Bobby Rush announced that after 3 decades on the Hill, he was finally retiring his seat. The reason I say it's a personal note is way, way back in the early 70s, I got to know Bobby Rush when I was a TV producer in Chicago, and Bobby Rush was, yes, the chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party, an organization which in those days many people thought of as being radical, revolutionaries, dangerous, armed militants, and yet Bobby and I were able to strike up a pretty positive relationship between a black activist and a white Jewish kid from the northern suburbs. Many years later, after I'd lost track of Bobby, I was in Washington for the start of a new Congress. I'm going to say 1986, probably. And I saw Bobby Rush walking toward me in the United States Capitol. And I looked and said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I've been elected to Congress." And he went on and served for 30 years. It just shows you that people can grow, evolve, and for 30 years, he's been a very effective congressman for his constituents back in Chicago. So I personally wish Bobby Rush well as he moves into the next phase of his campaign. By the way, he beat Barack Obama when Barack Obama tried to challenge him for that seat. We are out of time for today's show. Again, tomorrow we'll be on at 2 o'clock live. NPR takes over at 9 with coverage of January 6th anniversary tomorrow. In the meantime, take care. Stay healthy. Yes, wear your mask, probably an N95, and get a booster shot. See you all tomorrow.